Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good afternoon. Thank you for being here this afternoon. We have our lecture today as part of the Bachelor's Colloquium. And as you know, we have created this series of lectures from very well-known individuals to just help us as a campus to come together and primarily think about the issues that face higher education in the 21st century. Of course, living in today's events, you can imagine that these issues are very intense. They have to do with the expectations of us and our students in terms of the education they need to be successful. They have to do with, of course, our ability to provide the high-quality programs that we really want to do. It has to do with the funding we receive from the state and our ability to deliver on our promise as a land-grant university. And, of course, in today's environment, with everything that is happening here in the state, in the nation, and around the world, with the economic downturn, with the pressures on the individuals, on our students, the pressures on their families, the pressures on the state, on the legislators, legislation that also creates constraints or enable us to do things. The environment is very charged in many ways, and it's not just here, of course, in California. It's not just true in the UC or the CSU. Is true throughout the nation, and of course is true throughout the world. So we are inviting, we have been doing that because the symptoms, of course, and the issues have been there, and the symptoms of the deep problems that we are facing have been around for quite some time. And so we started the series to really bring individuals to help us think broadly about the issues and to help us put ourselves in the right context. So today we are very pleased to have with us Chuck Vest. I have to say that I met Chuck very early in my life, in fact, as an assistant professor at the University of Michigan. Chuck at the time was the associate dean. In 84, when I was hired as an assistant professor, he became the dean quickly after that, and then the provost at the University of Michigan, and then the president at MIT. And now the last 3 or 4 years has been the president of the National Academy of Engineering. Chuck has done wonderful things. He asked me not to say too much, so you can find out about him. But he has really led this country in many ways. He has raised awareness about the importance of higher education, the importance of research, the role of the research university in keeping our country competitive. And so we are very pleased to have him with us today. So we'll start with his lecture, and then we'll have a dialogue between Chuck and Enrique Lavernia, who is our Dean of Engineering. But I will come to introduce again both of them at that time. So, Chuck, thank you.
Thank you very much, Linda. It's really an honor to be here at the University of California, Davis, to present today's Chancellor's Colloquium. I've been proud, as you just heard, to have Linda Katehi as a colleague and a friend since I first knew her as an assistant professor at the University of Michigan, and let me assure all of you that throughout this nation, she is an admired educational leader. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, that I served for 17 years was established 150 years ago. It was founded to be a new and different kind of institution to serve the purposes of the emerging industrial age in the United States. Today, in the dawning decades of the 21st century, institutions are needed to serve the purposes of the emerging global knowledge-based economy and interconnected world. Around the world, many universities, based largely on the model of the American Research University, are being established with this purpose in mind. Prime examples are the King Abdullah University of Science and Technology, or KAUST, in Saudi Arabia, the Okinawa Institute of Science and Technology in Japan, OIST, the Singapore University of Technology and Design, SUTED, and the Skolkova Institute of Science and Technology in Russia, or SIST. So we have KAUST, OIST, SUTED, and SIST. Interestingly, much of the leadership, as well as the design of these and several other new universities, are being provided by educational innovators from the U.S. who see these institutions as opportunities for educational change. In the U.S., some important new universities, such as Olin College in the Boston area, have also been established in this context. But for the most part, because our research universities have been very energetic, successful, and somewhat intellectually flexible, our U.S. strategy is most likely going to be based on the evolution of existing universities. The times may call for transformation rather than evolution, but in any event, change must come. Change is called for from two major directions. First, globalization and the future ability of the United States to compete, innovate, and lead. And second, the need to keep our universities both excellent and accessible. One highly relevant characteristic of the globalization is the movement of people, ideas, and information. In the mid-20th century, we all spoke about brain drain. The implication was that many of the brightest and most energetic young men and women from all over the world emigrated to the U.S. or to Western Europe, where they found the most adventurous and well-funded universities in which to study or become faculty members, especially in recent years in science and engineering. These immigrants also became entrepreneurs and corporate leaders in their new country. But these talented individuals also were drained from their home countries, where some would argue that they were needed even more. As we move into the 21st century, we entered the current era of brain circulation. This means that bright young people now move around the globe, studying and doing business in many different countries that present opportunities to them. Our research universities and their students will serve the needs and meet the opportunities of our states and nation, but they will also be global citizens. This is very different from the more insular national context in which MIT was founded 150 years ago. But I think that today we are at the beginning of an even more exciting phenomenon that I call brain integration. By this I mean that researchers, students, and entrepreneurs all over the world are linked together by the Internet and the World Wide Web, and they soon will all have access to massive computing power through the so-called cloud. Increasingly, communities of scholars, scientists, engineers, and others in many different locations around the world will integrate their thinking with the data and analyses of large-scale computation to solve big problems. I believe that this brain integration will characterize the age in which our universities will leverage and expand their abilities to make major scientific and technical contributions to humankind. Brain integration will also contribute to the learning process in ways that, frankly, I can only see at this time sort of through a glass darkly. Indeed, things are stirring on this brain integration front. A highly interdisciplinary group at MIT has established the Center for Collective Intelligence, dedicated to answering a core research question: how can people and computers be connected so that collectively they can act more intelligently than any person, group, or computer has ever done before? A group of researchers at the University of Washington developed a computer game called Fold It to solve puzzles for science. This website attracts players from all over the world to collectively solve complex protein folding problems. Foldit's origins are telling. Researchers have often obtained the massive computing power they need to solve problems like this by chaining together a large number of PCs that are volunteered by their owners all over the world. One day, at least so to speak, the researchers thought, If we can integrate people's computers to solve very complicated problems, why can't we actually integrate their brains, that is, use their human intelligence and intuition collectively to solve such problems? Folded has proven to be effective, and it is also set up in a way that the gamers can learn about the actual science that they are involved with. Finally, I would note the interesting explorations of the gaming and learning world in a recent book by Douglas Thomas and John Seeley Brown, A New Culture of Learning. They conclude that a new culture of learning is emerging from the world of massive multiplayer games, that is, and I quote, a culture of collective inquiry that harnesses the resources of the network and transforms them into nutrients within the Petri dish environment, turning it into a space of play and experimentation, and where imagination's play, learning, happens. Do the concepts of brain circulation and brain integration imply that location of universities no longer matters? Absolutely not. Where universities are located certainly still matters. University campuses, in my view, will not become obsolete just because the world is interconnected by information technology. I think this is true for at least three reasons. First, teaching and learning are profoundly human activities. Machines can and will enhance these processes, and they will make vast amounts of information available. But I think that the magic that happens when students and scholars live and learn together will not be replaced. It will be greatly enhanced by information technology, but not replaced. The second reason that location still matters is that each university develops its own specific infrastructure for experimentation and analysis. One of the great promises of what I've called brain integration is that expensive equipment will not have to be duplicated on all different campuses. Rather, they can be shared in global collaborations. The third reason that location still matters is that universities exist in cultures. Despite the many forces that drive us towards sameness across the U.S., different universities, both public and private, do develop their own cultures, and may it always be so. Let me step back for a moment and give you my view of what the purpose of research universities is. We generally and properly think of ourselves as stewarding the ancient purposes of preserving knowledge of the past, teaching, and producing new knowledge and scholarship. These certainly are what we do. But in America, and especially in our great system of public universities, I like to think of our purpose in a different way. I like to think that the purpose of research universities is to create opportunity. A central objective is to provide opportunity for our graduates. Because of their education, they have the opportunity to become productive citizens, to do interesting and important jobs, and to pursue the life of the mind. But U.S. research universities also provide opportunity for business and industry. They do this by providing well-educated and well-trained employees, but even more profoundly, through their research, they provide ideas for new products, processes, and services. Here again, location does matter because face-to-face interactions of faculty, students, entrepreneurs, and business leaders can generate a synergy that is critically important in doing new things that can be successful. My friend and colleague Desh Deshpande, a very successful Indian-American entrepreneur, has taught me that successful entrepreneurs are men or women who understand the real needs of real people and who have an appreciation for what will or will not work in a given culture and location. Finally, the flow of people and ideas to and from research universities provides opportunities for states, regions, and nations. This is the opportunity to enhance economies, health, security, and quality of life. But here I want to add one caution. Patience and flexibility are required. It is very difficult to plan and predict exactly how and when a research university will advance the economy of a region. No one planned Route 128 around Boston, and no one even planned Silicon Valley. They emerged in large part because universities like MIT and Stanford brought smart, innovative, and adventurous faculty and students together, and because they developed strong interaction with local business people and companies. MIT and Stanford also share a critically important characteristic. In both of these institutions, the most fundamental research and scholarship exists side by side and in mutual respect with highly applied and even industry-relevant research. As academics, we generally think primarily of the flow of new ideas and technologies from our universities to companies. But in fact, we are one element of a very complex national innovation system. This is not a well-defined system. It's a complex flow of people, ideas, and money. It involves governments, universities, and industry. Though innovation has become part of the vernacular, possibly too much part of the vernacular, I find to my dismay that few people actually understand that research universities are truly central to innovation. Indeed, they are arguably the most important part of this system. Innovations originating in universities have created truly transforming opportunity to our nation and our world. Consider, for example, the following university-developed innovations: computing, the laser, the internet, numerically controlled machines, the fundamentals of the GPS system, the genomic revolution, the deployment of the World Wide Web, and most of modern medicine. There's not a job in America today that does not depend on one or more of these university-derived innovations. This is very serious business. Furthermore, studies show that there are other reasons that universities attract startups and other forward-looking businesses to their vicinity. Because universities help to provide an attractive intellectual and cultural environment that improves the quality of life for companies and their employees. They also tend to stimulate improvement in educational quality at all levels in their communities. In addition, they provide a stimulating and neutral venue where scientists, engineers, scholars, and business leaders can discuss openly topics of mutual interest. Research shows that these factors are very important to companies when they decide where to locate their businesses or laboratories. The mission to provide opportunity for our graduates is obviously broadly accepted. The mission of providing opportunities to states, regions, and especially businesses creates some tension within our universities. But in my view, these tensions must be positioned to be so-called creative tensions. Because I do believe that especially our great public universities, this purpose is both important and, when properly executed, is a noble one. Before addressing change and how to proceed in the changing context of globalization and financial stress, we should recognize that our U.S. research universities have been remarkably successful. We must not lose sight of how successful we have been, but neither can we rest on our laurels. I suggest six basic lessons from the experience of research universities in the 20th century. The first lesson is that teaching and research must be intimately intertwined and must be assigned equal importance. Teaching and research and scholarship are inseparable, and it is their synergy that defines the essence of a research university. Many years ago, Frederick Terman, then the provost of Stanford, was asked whether he wanted Stanford to be a teaching institution or a research institution. He answered that he wanted it to be a learning institution. The research university of the 21st century must also be devoted to learning in this broad sense, learning through discovery as well as learning through teaching and exploration of the past. In the long run, making universities exciting, creative, adventurous, rigorous, demanding, and empowering environments is far more important than the specific details of individual curricula or research programs. The second lesson is that the quality of a research university can be no better than the quality of its faculty. The faculty defines the university. The research university of the 21st century, therefore, must strive to attract, nurture, and empower the very best professors. This essential task of building a world-class faculty requires commitment, fortitude, patience, and adherence to high academic values as well as to aspirations. Some well-experienced, excellent senior professors need to be hired from time to time, but in the end, I believe that it is very important that young faculty grow up through the ranks of a university. Lesson three is that science can flourish only in an open environment. Science languishes in a closed environment. The free flow of people and ideas across institutional and political boundaries is essential to the functioning of a great university. The very process of conducting science requires that others challenge one's hypotheses, independently verify the results of experiments, and validate theoretical conclusions. Science simply cannot even be done in isolation. And of course, interactions among scholars, scientists, and engineers who have diverse perspectives and varied experiences leads to creativity and innovation. Such interchange is the very essence of a research university. Maintaining an intellectually open environment requires a high degree of institutional autonomy and protection from political and ideological forces. Lesson four is that it is essential to give great freedom to new young faculty members to study and teach what they believe is important. They should not function as assistants to senior faculty. The wisdom and perspective of senior scholars is obviously important, but most dramatic new insights and innovations come from brilliant young women and men. But with great intellectual freedom comes equally great responsibility. Thus, faculty, even early in their careers, must always be held to the highest academic standards, especially through the evaluation and constructive criticism inherent in peer review processes. The freshness that comes from young faculty and from the continual flow of students to the institution is key to a great research university. Lesson five is that competition among universities to attract and retain the best faculty and students, and competition among professors and research groups in the free marketplace of ideas engenders excellence. Such interinstitutional competition may at first seem expensive, inefficient, and complicated, especially because today's universities compete on a global scale. Nonetheless, I believe that competition drives improvement in research, teaching, educational policies, working environments, facilities, and most importantly, in ideas and people. Great professors attract great students, and great students attract great professors. Lesson six is that fundamental scholarship and research must exist on an equal plane with applied research and innovation. I emphasized this earlier in my talk. As we enter the 21st century, we are very aware that research universities create opportunity for nations and regions through the transfer of technology and innovation to the marketplace. Industrially relevant work is increasingly important, and an environment that is entrepreneurial also gives relevance to education. However, there is a danger that in our rush to solve practical problems and transfer technology to industry, we could lose our bearings and forget the still more profound purposes of universities to discover truths about nature, celebrate ideas, and advance the human spirit. We must not allow universities to become overly utilitarian, but universities are places where ideas must be exchanged, evaluated, and integrated. Even in an institution like MIT that is largely centered on science and engineering, truly fundamental research and scholarship conducted to discover truths about nature and the human condition play a central role equal to that of research that is applied quite directly and to the solution of major problems facing humankind. Both pure scholarship and applied research must be conducted with mutual respect. Both must be valued. Both must be subjected to the same rigorous standards. And this is important, they should inform each other. Now, I'm an incurable optimist, but I have to say that never in my lifetime has it been so hard to hang on to my optimism as it is today. I find myself slipping daily into one degree or another of pessimism. Washington is broken. I hope and expect that this is a temporary state, but it is broken in the sense that we are avoiding addressing the truly important issues of our time. Instead, our politics is focused on sideshows, and we are not exerting the kind of global leadership that people I meet all over the world actually long for us to exert again. I leave it to others to analyze why we are in such a problematic position, but in part, it may be because we continue to think in terms of American exceptionalism and the assumption that we always have been and always will be number one. Now, I have a different definition of American exceptionalism, and it's this. We are number one except when we're number 66, 11, 16, 22, 24, 27, or even 48. Indeed, we are number six in global innovation-based competitiveness. I can't believe this one. We are 11th in the percentage of our young adults who have completed high school. We are number 16 in college completion rates among the major nations. We are number 22 in broadband internet access for our citizens, number 24 in life expectancy at birth, number 27 in the fraction of our college graduates who earn science or engineering degrees. And while I know this is highly subjective, number 48 in the quality of K-12 math and science education. We have a huge national agenda that is not being tended to. But for now, let me stick to universities, because if they do not remain healthy, we don't have a prayer of getting back on track for the long haul. I'm very concerned about the financial pressures, especially on our public universities, and their long-term effect on accessibility. Even before the financial tsunamis that our country has endured in the last few years, the overall correlation of college attendance with family income had become troubling. Consider the relation between college attendance and high school achievement. Data are available about preparation in mathematics. They can reasonably be expected to serve as a proxy for high school academic achievement more broadly. And further, let us define for the moment low-income families as those who earn less than $30,000 a year, and define high-income families as those who earn more than $100,000 annually. What has been found is that 80% of the high-achieving kids from low-income families attend college. That's actually good. But what is perplexing is that this is essentially equal to the percentage of low-achieving but high-income kids who attend college. In other words, as far as college enrollment is concerned, it's just as good to be a low-achieving wealthy kid as to be a high-achieving poor kid. This does not describe the kind of need-blind meritocracy that our country should strive for. Now think about the pressures on universities. In the last decade, I need not tell this audience, the real state appropriation to public colleges and universities across the nation per student dropped about 20% overall. But the total cost to students and their family of attending a state university during this period increased by 52%. Such declining state support and the resultant tuition increases may even make sense in the near term, but it's not a sustainable situation. One highly exacerbating reaction to this situation is increasing the number of so-called merit-based, merit-based financial aid rather than need-based financial aid. A second likely reaction will be to cut back on course offerings or majors or curricula that have low numerical demand. A likely consequence also may be that we simply have fewer students from lower, middle, and low-income families. Next, think about the most common way in which universities address the devastating loss of state revenues to support undergraduate education. Here it is, at least in my view. A university located in State A, what does it do? It increases the number of students it enrolls who are residents of State B. Why? Because they can easily charge substantially higher tuitions for such out-of-state students. Now, of course, the universities in State B also are suffering from seriously decreased state appropriations, so they will seek to enroll more high-paying students from State A. This interchange of students will increase the geographic diversity of our student bodies, which arguably has educational benefits, but it inevitably also will drive up the average family wealth of students at both states, both universities. It's also likely that it will devote even more financial aid from the needy students to high-achieving but well-to-do students. If this spiral should continue rapidly upward, I think it will be a big setback for our belief in the importance of access to good education. Our noble aspirations have always been, in my view, well characterized by the motto adopted by the University of Michigan in the 19th century, an uncommon education for the common man. The architect of the American Research University as the primary institution funded by the federal government to perform the nation's basic research was Vannevar Bush. Vannevar Bush, a former engineering dean and vice president of MIT, headed the OSRD, the Office of Scientific Research and Development, that coordinated our nation's R&D establishments together with industry to serve the national effort during World War II. Near the end of the war, at President Roosevelt's request, he drafted the now famous report, Science, the Endless Frontier. This report is remembered because it set out a plan to build our national research infrastructure within our universities. This was a radical idea at the time. No other country had taken this approach. Science, the Endless Frontier, however, also proposed the establishment of the National Science Foundation. But the point I want to make today is that there was another profound element of Vannevar Bush's vision. In this report, he wrote, "If ability and not the circumstance of family fortune determines who shall receive higher education, then we shall be assured of constantly improving quality at every level of scientific activity." Excuse me. So I think this is a very important statement that to me is every bit as profound and important as the vision he laid out for the conduct of research. Today we must strive to heed this part of Vannevar Bush's vision, as well as to work to keep the research enterprise strongly funded. Suppose our goal has three parts. First, maintain access to our universities for bright and motivated students regardless of their financial means. Two, do this with diminished state funding. and 3, maintain excellence in our universities. If these are our goals and realities, then we have to somehow increase our educational productivity. Now, the P word, productivity, is something from which we academics instinctively recoil. But the fact is that in the long run, if we are to retain access in an era of restrained resources, somehow it does have to go up. But we must mean something by productivity that is more sophisticated than simply increasing class sizes and cutting out subjects. We need to improve all the outputs of education, such as learning, critical reasoning, creativity, time to degree, lifelong learning skills, and so forth. One important path, surely, is to explore higher levels of using information technology. What do I mean by higher levels? With that term, I'm trying to signal that we need to do much more than just deliver canned courses to the desktop computer. We need to develop systems that provide personalized learning to our on-campus students and engage faculty as true guides and teachers for those elements that cannot be enhanced through the use of IT. It will not work for all subject matter. It must be structured and developed using serious knowledge from cognitive science and human learning processes. Such approaches to personalized machine-enhanced learning are beginning to appear, but they need to be really thoroughly evaluated, understood, and improved. But the first goal should be to improve learning. If that goal can be achieved, then chances are good that costs can be lowered as well. We must aggressively explore this at scale. Now, my remarks today have focused largely on the American Research University from a national perspective. This is because the institution that we value so deeply is under financial stress. It is also because our nation today is wandering in a social and political wilderness and could easily lose sight of how essential our research universities are to our future economy, health, security, and quality of life. And we could easily slip back into a circumstance in which higher education and research are pastimes for the wealthy, rather than means to a better life across the socioeconomic spectrum. But even as we address these critically important national issues, we must keep our sights and values even higher and strive to be good citizens of the world as well as of the U.S. We must contribute to and learn from increasing globalization of higher education. We live in an age characterized by two opposing trends, integration and fragmentation. Because of modern travel, commerce, communications, all regions and all peoples of the earth are increasingly linked and integrated. We are linked and integrated also simply because we inhabit a single planet. We share its fragile environment. We share its ecosystems and finite resources. We are linked and integrated by a common desire of people everywhere to live peacefully and in good health. We are linked and integrated by our common curiosity about the world, the universe, and each other. We are linked by the knowledge and understanding developed by many people in many places in many periods of history. Yet at the same time, forces new and old cause us to fragment, to divide ourselves along fault lines of culture, history, geography, misunderstanding, and fear of the unfamiliar. Those of us gathered here today presumably share a common belief that the dominant trend of this age must be linkage and integration and not fragmentation. We believe that education, learning, discovery, and creation of opportunity will bind us together and enable us to collectively build peace and prosperity and to face the challenges of living together on this earth. We believe that knowledge and its wise use will elevate the quality of life all around the world. We believe that science and technology can play a central and indeed essential role in this quest. Indeed, the origins of the research university as we know it can be thought of as a first phase of globalization. Because, as you all know, the idea of combining advanced education and research was imported from Humboldt University in Germany by the Johns Hopkins University in the U.S. in the 19th century. During the rest of the 19th century and the 20th centuries, the idea was refined, expanded, and adapted to the new world here in the U.S. We developed both public and private research universities, ranging from the great land-grant universities to more focused institutions like MIT and Caltech. Then, amazingly, research universities propagated to Asia and ultimately back again to Europe in essentially the form developed here in the U.S. Today, research universities are being developed or transformed all over the world. In Asia, in India, in the Middle East, in Russia, largely as graduate institutions. This is a huge topic for another day, but let me make one observation. The scale of expansion planned for higher education in countries like India and China is simply beyond my imagination. The government of India speaks openly of establishing 800 to 1,000 new universities in the coming decade. It is very difficult for me to even contemplate anything of this scale, but I believe that the U.S. and India, for example, must learn from each other, because I suspect that the strategies that will make fast expansions possible in India will be closely related to the strategies that are needed to increase productivity and sustain access in American universities. In the 21st century, competition and cooperation are the yin and yang of globalization in higher education and in other domains. Competition among research universities worldwide simply drives excellence. Competition also signals that we should value diversity of institutional types, cultures, and approaches. But we must also cooperate if we are to meet our shared challenges, use our finite resources well, and advance our shared knowledge and humanity. Global cooperation in research will take many forms, ranging from brain integration, as I called it, for solving complex problems, to shared use of expensive facilities, often with access via cyber infrastructure. But global cooperation in learning and access to knowledge is more immediate, and it must be built on a foundation of openness. At MIT, I became passionate about sharing knowledge because the role of universities is to create opportunity, and people everywhere need that opportunity. Indeed, the faculty of MIT established MIT OpenCourseWare and committed itself to putting their teaching materials for over 2,000 subjects on the World Wide Web for anyone to use anywhere, anytime, free of charge. We learned that many people sought and valued this knowledge. It has been accessed all over the world by teachers and self-learners alike. Other universities also have concluded that this is a good idea. OpenCourseWare has now evolved from an MIT initiative to a global movement. Indeed, recent books such as Richard DeMillo's Abelard to Apple and Taylor Walsh's Unlocking the Gates presents this OpenCourseWare movement as the beginning of a revolution in global higher education. There are, of course, many other examples now of freely or inexpensively available scholarly and teaching materials, library resources, online courses, and other educational tools, and even web-based laboratories. In my view, this is all about openness and sharing of resources. Openness is a true spirit of education, democratization, and empowerment. It underpins innovation, cooperation, and competition worldwide. It enables sharing and accessing initially expensive and intellectually intensive materials. It speaks of institutional and national values. Of course, scholars have for multiple centuries shared knowledge and resources through books, journals, and scholarly meetings. But what is new today is the scope, reach, speed, and interaction suddenly made possible by the ubiquitous Internet and World Wide Web. Indeed, I think these changes are profound and that something very fundamental is happening. In the mid-20th century, Clark Kerr, whose vision and talent gave rise to California's remarkable system of higher education, realized that the American Research University had expanded and transformed into a multiversity, encompassing fields of study and social purposes far beyond the historic traditions of universities. Similarly, I believe that in the 21st century, what we are observing is the early emergence of a meta-university, a transcendent, accessible, empowering, dynamic, communally constructed framework of open materials and platforms on which much of higher education worldwide can be constructed or enhanced. The meta-university will enable, not replace, residential universities. It will bring cost efficiencies to institutions through shared development. It will be adaptable, not prescriptive. It will serve both teachers and learners. It will speed the propagation of high-quality education and scholarship, build capacity for economic development, build bridges across cultures and political boundaries, and be especially important to the developing world. In closing, we must rekindle our national commitment to the research university as the prime provider of opportunity for a diverse population, regardless of family wealth, for states, for regions, and our nation. Simultaneously, we must promote openness and provide leadership in openness, sharing, and creation of opportunity for individuals and economies throughout the world. Thank you very much for your attention.
What we are going to do next is we'll ask Enrique Lavernia, our Dean of Engineering, to come forward. And Chuck and Enrique will have a discussion during this time that we can ask questions and you can take it from there. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, thank you again, Chuck, and let me add welcome on behalf of the faculty, the staff, and the students of our campus and our college. It's a pleasure to have you here. Appreciate your time, and thank you for an enlightening lecture. So as the chancellor noted, I will start off the discussion with one leading question, and then we'll invite the audience to please participate. And there's a microphone in the back, and so please raise your hand, and they'll reach you.
Which way do you mean leading question?
Well, I'm intrigued by the interface of the interface between industry and the research university. That's an interface that's been fraught with peril for many institutions, but it's also an area where MIT has done a particularly outstanding job. And so, as you talk about the concept of the meta university, where do you see that interface going? What are the lessons that we've learned from the past, and what are the opportunities that exist in the future?
Well, first of all, the way I think about the world is that it is the private sector that actually brings products and services and processes to the marketplace that generates wealth, that provides jobs, ultimately enhances our quality of life, certainly if done properly. And at different periods in time, the sources of this new knowledge has differed. And today, in the United States, in 2011, really universities are the only game in town for developing the two essential things that we need. One are new ideas, new technologies, and obviously educated young men and women. These are the raw materials that the private sector, as well as the government and those things that it provides, needs. If we cut off those two sources, either of bright young people or innovative new ideas and new technologies, then I don't see how we move forward at all. Now, the irony of all of this is that this model, which the United States, and I'm speaking mostly politically here, has sort of come to take for granted and even forgotten about the effort and the years to build it and the role of Bush's vision and so forth. While we are sort of forgetting this, the rest of the world is discovering it. As you know, I was privileged to be a member of a group through the National Academies, at the request of a bipartisan group in the House and Senate, drafted a report called Rising Above the Gathering Storm, which tried to simply get at what are the fundamentals in education and in our research and in our tax policies and so forth are needed to keep America strong. And our wonderful chair, Norm Augustine, who just gives so unselfishly of every minute of his life to trying to move this agenda forward for the nation, likes to point out that virtually every one of our recommendations has been implemented, but not in the United States. And so other countries are taking our model and they are running with it. We still have a few comparative advantages, in my view. I happen to believe that we still spawn better creativity, even in the technical world, because our engineers and our scientists, for the most part, are educated in institutions where they mix with, take part with, integrate the humanities and the social sciences, and to use my pet idea, especially the arts. That gives us a leg up. But the rest of the world's beginning to discover that now. And China is trying, Singapore is moving forward. And so just to compete, we've got to keep the fundamentals straight. Now, specifically to the role of the meta-university, I think of it primarily as part of the educational process, although the same thing is certainly going on in the world of science. People who work on the environment or who work on telescopes and things like that, they are all linked together and do things jointly around the world. But we're just beginning to do it educationally. And I think what that is going to do more than anything else, at least it's my hope, is it's going to give kids in the developing world a big boost upward to kind of accelerate the development at the lowest cost possible of their education and give those kids a chance at having a good quality of life and health. So I think these are all wound together, and we can just no longer think of ourselves in isolation because we're not isolated.
Thank you. I'd like to open it for questions from the audience. Please introduce yourselves.
Kerry Athanasio, the chair of biomedical engineering. This was a magnificent lecture in so many ways. There were many, many important lessons that you shared with us, but one of them really stuck in my mind and I think stands out. That is the statement that you made over there that virtually every job in the United States emanates from or has emanated from inventions and technology that was university-based. And this is a very timely statement to make in light of the fact that all of us in the academic world are the recipients of wrath and financial cuts and budgetary constraints and all of that. My question to you is this: for something that is so crystal clear of a statement and of a lesson, why have we been unable to get that message out to the people who control the purse strings, our states, mm-hmm. our legislatures, at all levels in Washington? Why have we not been able to do so effectively?
Well, I can share at least some thoughts, but before I do, I want to reinforce the question. Excuse me. I want to reinforce the question. I had about a year and a half ago what I call an out-of-body experience. I had a great opportunity because the Aspen Institute runs a congressional breakfast every now and then, maybe once a month, sometimes twice. And it's first come, first serve. In Washington talk, it's principles only. That is, you have to be a senator or a member of the House of Representatives. You have about 25 or so seats at the breakfast table. And they bring one person in and on some topic known in advance. And that person has 15 minutes to say what he or she has to say. And then there's 45 minutes plus however long they stick around after that to ask questions and debate. So I had the wonderful opportunity of being the speaker because we had just released our five-year look back at what had happened since the original Rising Above the Gathering Storm came out. And I began my talk by going through those six things, where we rank in the world. And I want to tell you, they didn't have a clue. Now, there were four or five people there, senators and representatives, who knew those numbers inside out, knew way more, knew what was behind them. But most of them hadn't a clue. They audibly gasped. They gasped. And after it was over, I asked one of the staffers who was sitting over, I said, did I hear what I thought I heard? He said, yes. I went, oh. And the whole conversation then was back and forth among them saying the same thing. What is wrong with us? You know, why are we allowing these things to happen to our children? And this was all over the political spectrum, believe me. And so it both reinforced to me the idea that people don't understand where we are today, and that we just are not communicating it well. So when I left, I said, what should I take home from this? And they very clearly said, I forget who it was, sort of acted as a spokesperson. They said two things. Number one, keep telling everybody how badly the country is slipping. Don't hesitate to deliver the bad news. And secondly, be sure that you get people to understand that you're not advocating these things just because you want to produce more scientists and engineers, but these are things that affect everybody. And so, you know, there's some hope that maybe if you keep on. Now, to get a little closer to your question, my experience is that what's important goes back to Tip O'Neill's famous "All Politics is Local." What is really important is that you do, and I saw some great examples of what's going on here at Davis today and in serious outreach into the K-12 system, but working with real kids, real parents, real businesses, and just making it known locally and hopefully to your congressman and so forth, that's the only hope we have. We just have to start there. And we'll keep doing our best at the national academies and so forth and the AAU and the institutional associations to get this big picture out. But what you really have to do is you just have to get people locally to understand it. And it's a sad slippage. I grew up, as some of you know, in West Virginia, which is one of our smaller and poorer states. And I remember about the time I was in junior high school, the state decided that they needed to build a new hospital at the university for the medical school. And the whole thing was funded by a 2-cent tax on every bottle of soda or pop or whatever you prefer to call it was. And all the people in the state, they had such ownership of that place. You know, that's our hospital. And this is the spirit that's missing today. And it's a tough economic time we're all dealing with, but if we don't get people to understand the purpose, the function, and who benefits, we don't have a chance of addressing these problems.
Yes, sir. Thank you for speaking. And when you talked about West Virginia, it brought up something in my mind. I grew up in Tulare, California, which, if anybody knows, it's, well, for some who know, it's like the Appalachia of the West. They say. And as a migrant farm worker kid who was fortunate of a family of 15 to go off to university in 1986 and graduated from UC Davis eventually. And, you know, growing up that way really put a lot of, like some people call it chutzpah, animo, different things people call it, depending on the language. I think one of the best things that University of California has done recently is UC Merced. As a migrant farm worker kid who grew up picking fruit in that area, I can tell you firsthand that I think it's going to be a wonderful investment 50 years down the road. Recently in the Guardian newspaper, actually yesterday, I read an article about a kid, Joaquin Luna, an undocumented immigrant in Texas who committed suicide, purportedly because of a lack of hope regarding the DREAM Act. And, you know, this kid was bright. He was a good student and had a big future ahead of him. Kind of reminded me of myself and, you know, spoke to that. And I wonder if you could address that issue, the fact that, you know, we talk about competition drives innovation or something of that to that effect. And I like to think about it in a different way of looking at it, cooperation and competition. Because if I look at competition, America has outdone the rest of the world many times over, and I think we export a lot of things, but what we don't export enough of is our democracy, and maybe not our democracy giving it to the Middle East or to Mexico or to Latin America, but maybe their version of their democracy, but using us as a template. And I wonder if you could speak to how it is that we could promote more cooperation between the United States and exporting that part of ourselves, you know. And I guess another part of that is our children. You made that comment a little while ago, and I think to myself, you know, if I was a middle-aged Caucasian or a grandparent, a Caucasian grandparent, I'm thinking, who are my kids? You know, is it the little Asian kid? Is it the little Indian kid, little Mexican kid? Who are our children? And I think that speaks largely to what's needed. That conversation has to take place. I think our Attorney General Holder spoke to that about three or four years ago, and I think it's an important topic.
You've brought up several things. I don't know I can, and you've been very articulate. I'm not sure I can add much to both your question and the implications of the question. But, you know, we're a country of immigrants, and I especially look to engineering because I know it well, but it's true of a lot of other fields as well. Our universities, and engineering specifically, have always been the upward path for the last folks that arrived here. It's just the way it's been, and it's been a great contribution to America. And I, for one, deeply believe that the diversity of our population or at least certainly can be, our greatest strength. I just really believe that's true. And we are amazingly diverse despite all our problems compared to most of the rest of the world. But when it comes to things like the fate of the DREAM Act, I'm sorry, I'm just from another planet or something. I can't understand. I really, financial pressures, everything else, I cannot understand how anybody can oppose that concept. And I don't like to get off into partisan politics, but I was, by the way, thrilled at what Newt Gingrich said the other night in the debate. Now, I happen to know him pretty well, and he is a very smart guy, has lots of ideas, some of them good, some of them aren't. But I was just thrilled that he at least had the nerve to stand up and say. And then I watched the news coverage, and they missed, to me, the main point of what he said. They all reported that Gingrich said we shouldn't deport anybody who's lived in the United States for 25 years and pays taxes and works and belongs to the church and has kids and grandchildren. What he actually began by saying was, I can't believe that Americans are going to do this, which is a very, very different thought. So I'm sorry if I'm rambling a little bit. This is kind of a topic I get emotional on. One of the things that may happen is there was a very interesting article 2 days ago in the New York Times they showed what is already the impact of Alabama's new anti-immigration policies and laws. It is killing their economy visibly within the first few months. And so, you know, maybe we're going to have to learn the downside of this in order to gain the upside. So I'm sorry if I'm not directly answering your question, but I believe that the way we should export democracy and what's good about this nation is through our example and our actions. That's why I'm so worried about statistics. It's not that, you know, sure, I'd like to be number one in everything, but I'd like to be doing the right things here, as I think we have for a long time, so that the rest of the world wants to emulate us, not because we tell them they should or say this is the best system, but we have to get there. And, you know, when I get depressed, I always hearken back to something that Winston Churchill once famously said, and he actually did say it. It's not apocryphal. He said at some point after the Second World War, you can always count on the Americans to do the right thing. After they've exhausted all other possibilities. And I'm just hoping that we're going through that exhausting phase now and we're going to get back on track. But you know, at the end of the day, if we lose the kind of human values that don't want to give kids who, through circumstances that they obviously have absolutely nothing to do with, can't get an education in our country, then I will worry about us. I just can't believe we're not going to get past that in the next few years, I hope.
My name is Rick Heal. I'm chair of electrical and computer engineering. Once upon a time, corporate research labs like Bell Laboratories and IBM's Research Center drove the communications and computer industries. That ended about 15 years ago when those laboratories scaled back quite a bit. The university is in a position to take over that role, but there are a few things that are missing. One is at Bell Labs, and I happen to work at both of those laboratories, there was a lot of freedom and autonomy to do blue sky research on the R side of R&D. But there were also organizations in a spectrum toward the D side of R&D.
Sure.
And they were coupled by the lunch table, seminars, being on the same premises. That's not the case at a university. Also, another element that's missing at a university to take over that role is the overall corporate need that drives those activities toward making a computer, making a telephone. That's also missing at a university. So I think that something needs to change if the university is able to take over that role. Some change has to take place to fill those gaps, provide those elements to the organization. I don't find that it happens in the same way at the university as it did in the corporate research labs. I know you've had some relationship with IBM and you've thought about these interactions between industry and university, and I wonder if you see it that way too and if you have any solutions.
Yes and no, and it's obviously a topic that you probably know even more about than I do. I think if we get fixated on sort of how do we recreate what we did in the past, we'll be in trouble. Bell Labs was a beautiful, wonderful thing. By the way, a couple of my friends there keep reminding me they're still there. It is actually misunderstood by a lot of the world because a lot of people point to it and say, gee, at Bell Labs you could do whatever you want, and out came the transistor. As you know, that was actually a very thoughtful process. What are we going to do to replace vacuum tubes? So they were able to set a sort of a strategy, but a very nice broad road in which people could contribute to this. You know, where we are today, for better or worse, is that we have tried to replace that function by our universities as virtually the only people doing much basic long-time horizon research. coupled to larger industry through spin-offs and entrepreneurship and so forth and so on. And as you know, that system's getting a little worn and maturing. And then on top of this, I think the world is more complex today because now we do have really this sort of open innovation system going all over the world where people get from all over. But I said something in my talk, maybe I didn't say it exactly the same way, but when I was talking about why location still matters, it does still matter that I think universities can provide, and some do, at least a surrogate for that lunch table. And I will tell you, as I'm sure you know, but if you walk around the Broad Institute or the Whitehead or the biology department or what have you at MIT, any given day, you'll find a bunch of people from outside the institution who are there working, learning, going to seminars, talking. So you can try to build some of that yeast. But we have not truly replaced something that Bell Labs did, which is both have a long-term strategy of sort of what's the ultimate goal here, and do work. And where that's beginning to I think, show up especially is in the whole set of issues around manufacturing in the United States. There's just no group that's doing that. So I think we have to try to optimize our interactions with companies, and we have to be more creative in finding ways to interface things like the center that Desh Deshpande got started for technological innovation at MIT that allows us to work with small companies. But I don't see a way in which universities are going to literally replace Bell Labs. But you did say one thing that I appreciate, which is that those huge contributions were almost all in communication technology, and they dominated that literature. There are other areas in which places like Bell and IBM did not play. So I have no simple answer to it, but I think if we don't keep bridging and talking and working with small companies, large companies, understanding their problems, getting great new ideas to work on, then we surely won't keep the same kind of innovation that we had in the glory days of Bell.
If I can add, sure. You talked about models that other countries have adopted. The National University of Singapore in Dubaiopolis is mm-hmm. a new model of actually building an entire city next to the university to spawn a new interaction between the needs of industry and the researchers in academia in a very proactive way. Which appears to be very successful.
Yes, they're doing some great things, and interestingly, even though this isn't where they started out, where they are at the moment, as you know, Singapore reinvents itself about every 3 or 4 years, but what they are thinking of themselves now is as an innovation hub. They're not necessarily trying to do it all themselves for themselves, but they want to play with along those spokes all around the world. So it is a slightly different model, and they've attracted some very good people.
I'm Ken Varasub, a distinguished professor, Department of Geology. I've just returned from 2 years in Washington, D.C. as a Jefferson Science Fellow.
Oh, good for you.
Thank you.
Thank
and
you.
And Senior Science Advisor in the State Department and other agencies. And one of my epiphany, in a way, was the discovery of the pervasive skepticism, if not outright disdain, for the research paradigm as presently practiced at American universities. And I'm thinking of people getting endless NSF grants, NIH grants, and sort of never quite getting it done. And people who wanted results, who needed results, were very frustrated by all of that. If you fold that in to your remarks about globalization and open access, does that suggest that we need a new paradigm for the funding of research at American universities? And if so, what might it be? I mean, NSF is not even allowed to give money to foreign researchers outside of the United States, for example.
Well, I understand exactly what you're saying. I may be wrong. I think that attitude is actually driven far less by people's view of NSF as it is with NIH. And, you know, promising in the 50s that cancer was going to be cured and so forth and so on. So, yes, there is some great unhappiness and some resentment. I've been trying to think for years whether there is a really effective new paradigm to be had. And I'm not sure that there is. What I think we need is more experimentation with the way in which research is funded. I think the biggest mistake we could make is to sort of trash this existing system that, for all its faults, has actually done wondrous things for America and for the world. But we really need more things like ARPA-E that came out of our gathering storm, where we collectively thought, this is one area where we really do need to do things in a different way, and let's look back at the early days, in this case not of Bell Labs, but the early days of ARPA, and see if we can't kind of create that kind of new approach that funds very high-risk, high-benefit research that focuses collectively on small companies and universities and really gets new players on an important national problem. I think ARPA is off to a great start. DARPA itself, by the way, is kind of reinventing itself yet again, a little bit more in the old mold. So I think in the agencies, we need to do some more things like that. So in my view, rather than tamper with NSF, I would get the mission agencies like DOD and Energy and NASA and so forth to try some new paradigms, at least on a problem set, and see if they do work better. Because, as you know, DARPA and ARPA, they have a very different approach, very different way of judging. They're very lean, flexible organizations. They bring really bright people in to serve for 2 or 3 years as program directors and monitors and so forth. They will cut your funding off if you're getting nowhere. They'll fund you for a long time if you're making progress toward a goal, but it turns out to be very hard. So I'm more for let's experiment in a few specific areas and see if we do find something that works better. Because, as you know, if you look across all the research budgets, NSF is not that big a piece of the pie. It's a very important piece because it funds certain areas of fundamental research that nobody else does, and so you have to protect it. But I think the mission agencies can experiment a little bit more. And one of the big worries about the current budgetary situation is that those things may get chopped out, and then we're really in trouble.
Ron Suhu of Electrical Engineering. Being an MIT graduate, I'm very happy to hear the Institute took the lead to make course materials available throughout the world through the Internet. My question is very simple, actually. I'm sure as you read the material, you're going to have questions. Are there established channels where you could easily access the relevant professor at MIT for answers?
The basic answer is no. And so we think of OpenCourseWare as really a new form of publication more than anything else. It's not offering degrees, it's not actually teaching classes, but it's making the way that faculty has organized knowledge and transferred it and put it out there for people to use and adapt to their local circumstances and so forth. Now that we've met the basic commitment we made to our funders, which were largely the Mellon Foundation and the Hewlett Foundation, of getting all, it's actually 2,100 subjects up now. Now OCW is beginning to experiment with some other things that it's going to have a much higher rate of video content. There is some discussion of making some parts of it available with access, but right now there's actually a filter in there. It's hard to get to the person who originated the notes because we knew that if this became a huge burden on faculty, then they weren't going to volunteer their subjects. So we haven't done that. What has surprised us is it's got a lot of on-campus use, and it's proven to be a really exciting conduit to high school kids. But we don't answer questions.
Well, please join me in thanking Dr. Chuck Vest for an absolutely delightful lecture and discussion.
Thank you very much.
I would like also to thank our wonderful visitor, I would say. We've been looking forward to having Chuck Vest here on our campus. I would like to thank Enrique Lavernia for facilitating the Q&A. And I would like to thank all of you for being here this afternoon. We'll have a small reception in the lobby, so we'd like to invite all of you to come and interact with our visitor a little more. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.